Spirit Blade Underground, episode 454. Warning, access restricted. Please submit to DNA verification. Processing. Verification complete. Access granted. Welcome. Audio file encryption processing. Transmission decoded. Begin playback for system file. Spirit Blade Underground, episode 454.
Hello, hello, and welcome to the Monitor Room at the Spirit Blade Underground Podcast, a biblical examination and celebration of geekery and geek entertainment, as well as the official podcast of Christian Geek Central, a website and community you can check out at christiangeekcentral.com. I'm Peter Franson from Spirit Blade Productions, producing entertainment and resources to hopefully equip, encourage, and inspire Christian geeks like you and me to live more and more for Christ. For more info and free goodies, check out spiritblade.com. On the show today, some of my thoughts on cosmic star heroin, and that's the superhero kind, not the kind that you inject. Hopefully you don't inject. I don't inject. None of us should inject. Anyway, that's on the PS4. Also coming out, I think, on PC this week, but it's inspired heavily from Chrono Trigger in a kind of a retro style. So I've very much been looking forward to that, and I'm going to share my thoughts on that today. Also, I'm going to try and shine a spotlight on a Christian geek website that I think is doing some good things, and also some Christian geek YouTube channels that might interest you. Plus, a sample of my personal process as I evaluate a biblical viewpoint that's been presented to me recently. So, all that, and I was going to say more, but not really much more. Mostly just all that, and then a few bumpers and transitions. All right, let's do it. Well, I just finished my, I don't want to say my playthrough, but I just finished playing the first 3 hours of Cosmic Star Heroin, which released on the PS4 this week. I think it also is out right now on PC, but I'm not sure. It's heavily inspired by Chrono Trigger, which released on the Super Nintendo back in the mid-90s, which I played as soon as it came out and really enjoyed that one a lot. I was a big fan of JRPGs at that time. And but since then, I don't want to say my tastes have moved me away from turn-based RPGs, because they certainly haven't. I really enjoyed the Shadow Hearts trilogy. I've enjoyed most of what was that game called? Lost Odyssey. That's right, on the Xbox 360. I'm not as much into like the tactical, RPGs, but Etrian. No, not Etrian. What's it called? Elminage Original is a game that I've been playing on my Vita and my PlayStation TV, and so all these are very, turn-based games. One of the differences is that in a game like Elminage, or also in Shin Megami Tensei Nocturne, if you've played that one before, and also I think in Dragon Quest, what was that? Dragon Quest 7, 8? I can't remember the one that came out on PS2. But those are strictly turn-based. There's no like active time battle system. But the turns, if you know what you're doing, they fly by really fast. There's not these big drawn-out animations and stuff that slow things down. And there's also, in I think all of those games, some important strategic choices to be made each turn. So you don't just find yourself, hitting attack, 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 and then waiting for those animations to finish, and then attack, attack, and then healing every now and then, attack, attack, attack. No, most of those games, they have significant choices to make each turn related to status effects that you want to cure or avoid, or placement of your heroes, in the front row or the back row, or, the status effects that you want to put on enemies, or the elemental attributes that they have, like they're fire, so you want to use a water spell on them. You know, so there are these important choices to make in those turn-based games, and that's something that's really important to me when I'm playing something that's strictly turn-based. If it's not that kind of game, then I really need some kind of element that'll keep me engaged. And games tried that with the active time battle system. That's what Square really did with the Final Fantasy series, starting with Final Fantasy 2/4 released in the U.S. And onward, and that didn't really do anything for me. You know, yeah, it just forced me to have to make decisions more quickly. I would rather not have to make, you know, basic decisions more quickly, but have to make more interesting decisions each turn, and then just control my own pace and move at a quick pace if I'm ready to do that, and take a little more time if I want to take more time. You know, what I really liked was the Shadow Hearts system, where you make your choices, and they actually do have lots of status effects that you got to think about and factor in, you know, attributes more than, you know, like elemental attributes more than status effects. But then when it's time to execute your move, you have to hit your X button at a certain time, you know, in order for your move to be effective. And so that kind of kept me, you know, engaged. I really enjoyed that style of combat. And there's not really been a turn-based JRPG that's really used quite the same system. Lost Odyssey tried to do something similar, but it didn't work near as well. So anyway, you know, looking at Cosmic Star Heroine, I was curious, you know, what are they going to do? In the promotional materials, they talked about this being a game that brings kind of the best of old school JRPGs and also the lessons learned in modern, you know, role-playing games, you know, and combining them into one retro/modern JRPG type of experience. And I think they've done a little bit of that. I mean, for as far as what I'm looking for, what I see is like the main evolutions of, you know, modern RPGs. The main thing that I noticed that they take from modern, more Western RPGs is the ability to save basically anywhere, anytime, which is so awesome, because in so many JRPGs, you have to commit to, you know, like a dungeon with limited save points that might mean that, like, you know, you're walking around this dungeon and 45 minutes between save points and it's time to go to bed, or you have something else that in just real life that needs your attention, you know, and you don't know where the next save point, maybe it's around the next corner, but you thought that the last, you know, three corners, and so you still don't know how close you are to that next save point. Life is beckoning, and sometimes you just have to say, crap, there goes the last 45 minutes of my evening, you know, I'm gonna have to do this all over again, I have to shut it off now, you know. And I hate finding myself in that kind of situation when I'm playing JRPGs. And so the ability to save anywhere is a really big deal, and it was to me. And it was one of their, you know, main marketing descriptions is, this game respects your time. Save anywhere. It's like, great, you know. But other than that, you know, I was surprised at kind of like how traditional it is. The battle screen is like Chrono Trigger in that, you know, there are no random battles. You see the enemies on the screen, and if you get too close to them, then battle music starts up. Everybody kind of runs to a different part of the screen and gets in their starting position for combat, and then combat ensues. But a big difference is that there's no active time battle system. It's strictly turn-based. You can take as much time as you want in making your decisions, which, you know, again, I do appreciate, as long as the decisions are interesting. And I think for the most part, the decisions are interesting that are made during combat. There are, you know, elemental weaknesses to take into account. There are status effects that you have to cure or guard against, you know. And there are also four difficulty settings from the get-go in this game. And normally I choose, you know, the very easiest of difficulty settings, especially in action games. This one I was like, you know, I really want to see what this game has to offer. So I chose the second to highest, which I was actually making my way through the game on that difficulty level. But it was making my way through in that at the end of, you know, common, normal, you know, level, you know, monster battles, you know, not boss fights. I would find myself just surviving by the skin of my teeth, or, well, I shouldn't say that, because but maybe out of my three character party, one of my guys would always be dead by the end of the battle, you know, and it's not that big of a deal when you get all your HP back after the battle is done, you get all your abilities recharged and all that kind of stuff after the battle is done, you know, and even the people who have fallen in battle still get experience. So it's not that big of a deal. But there was just something I just didn't like the feeling about that. I was like, ugh, I don't want to feel beat down at the end of every battle. Like, I just barely made it. I want to feel victorious. I want to feel like, you know, my choices led to a clean victory, you know? And so I did end up during my first 3 hours, about halfway through, dialing the difficulty down by one step. And I think that was a good choice. I don't know. I may go back again to the difficulty that I started at, but because I did start kind of losing interest a little bit and thinking to myself, I don't know if I see myself playing this game for longer than like 45 minutes at a time. You know, when I'm doing these trial and error video reviews, time is of the essence. And so I will spend, you know, I try to get through the first 5 hours of a game most times when I'm playing an RPG, and I basically try to do that in as straight through as possible, you know. And normally when I'm playing games, you know, at the end of a workday, I have on average, you know, 2, maybe 3 hours in an evening to play a video game or something like that. And so to spend more than that at a time playing a single game is really unusual for me. So, I guess from my experience, that's not going to be a big knock on the game to say that, you know, I won't want to play it for more than 45 minutes or something, because I have other games that fit that category. And so I can get through 2 or 3 games, different games in a night and, you know, have a nice game, you know, a nice variety in my game playing for an evening. But this isn't one that I would see myself, you know, saying, okay, when I do have those times where I don't have any other responsibilities and I can just give 3 to 4 hours in a row to a single game, I don't think this is going to be that game. I do enjoy the aesthetics of the game quite a bit. There's a lot more variety in them than, say, I Am Setsuna, which is another game that came out about 6 to 9 months ago, I think, which was also heavily inspired by Chrono Trigger and games of that era. And the graphics were much smoother and sharper and more detailed and all that kind of jazz in I Am Setsuna, but the environments were a lot more similar everywhere you went, and the character designs were not really distinct from each other. And the abilities that characters had did not really make them stand out from each other. There was just a lot of sameness going on in that game. And I still keep telling myself, you know, I want to go back to it. I did try to go back to it a little bit recently. I was just like, oh yeah, I'm remembering some of my issues with this. But after playing Cosmic Star Heroine, I'm like, no, I want to give it another try. I can't remember exactly what my problems were. Now I lost my train of thought. Oh yeah, just the variety in this one. It's mostly a science fiction setting, although there's, you know, magic is clearly involved. It's in, like, takes place on another planet in a totally different world from our own. And so it's nice just for that, to be in this kind of sci-fi setting instead of a fantasy setting for a JRPG. They're just not quite as common, you know. And I really enjoy, you know, even though it doesn't have the graphical fidelity as, say, I Am Setsuna, it's got a lot of interesting things to look at just the same. It uses the graphics well. And for me, that's the ultimate test. It's not like how sharp and smooth and detailed the textures are and all that kind of stuff. It's are they able to effectively use the graphical parameters they've decided to work within to present an interesting world to me, which is why I think a lot of these kind of retro style games can still look really great, because the art design behind those jaggies that we're looking at was really strong and did a good job of conveying the world and, you know, doing what they needed to do so that our imaginations could smooth out the jaggies and fill in the blanks and see the world that they're intending to show us, you know. I'm definitely not the type of person that just, if you give me a game with jaggies and retro style graphics, I'm like, it's gonna do something nostalgic for me, you know. No, I need it's really the art design behind all that I want to be interesting. So and I thought that was the case here. I also like the music. There's a good variety of music. It starts out as pretty lighthearted and, I don't know, kind of jazz style and very much kind of like lighthearted anime. And it really maintains that. But what's weird, and I guess anime is like this too, you know, where the dialogue will be kind of cheesy and lighthearted, and yet there'll be some elements in the story that are really dark and twisted. You know, like you're on this planet where, you know, you're exploring and there are all these monsters you're coming across that are dead, And but then there's like these robot AI things that have gone amok, and what they do is they find these monster dead bodies and they attach themselves to them and they reanimate these dead bodies of these monsters. So they're like these zombie, you know, robot mashup creatures, and it's really a dark kind of twisted concept for you know, an enemy type that you'd be fighting. And I thought that was really cool. And the music design is can also be very moody at times. So. But I mean, it's, you know, so it's this weird kind of juxtapositioning of kind of moodiness and dark concepts with cheesy anime style dialogue. And but it's not voiced at all. And that makes a big difference for me. So when I see sprites in this kind of like retro 16-bit style, you know, being overly expressive and their dialogue being really cheesy, for some reason, it doesn't bother me that much, if at all. Because I can just make it sound better and more understated or something in my head. It was when we added voice acting to these games and kept all that overstated physical expression from the characters on the screen and overstated and crazy over-the-top dialogue. And then we just added crazy, overly inflected performances to that. It was way too much. but that's, you know, when we take the voice acting out of the equation for me, I'm really able to enjoy an experience like this. And all, and you know, and I can also fire through the text dialogue and stuff and just kind of keep track of the story and, you know, not have to suffer through a big prolonged scene with the voice actors that are, you know, overdoing everything, you know, because they've been told to do that or it's part of the style or whatever. I can just kind of fire through that stuff really fast. And yet at the same time, it's not like, say, a Pillars of Eternity or a Baldur's Gate or a Torment, you know, style PC RPG where there's tons of text to read and there's even prose to read, and it's, you know, kind of like, whoa, someone really just wanted to exercise their writing muscles, you know. And either way, whether it's, you know, reading a bunch of prose or, you know, a bunch of text or you know, voice acted scenes, I'm rarely really engaged personally in stories that are created for video games. I almost never find them interesting. And so this is actually the nice kind of like sweet spot where there's just a little bit of cheesy dialogue that I can fire through and keep track of the plot. I don't have to I don't have to read a ton of prose and detail and conversations that go on and on that aren't interesting to me. Neither do I have to sit through these performances voice actors that are driving me up the wall or that just completely bore me or whatever. So so in terms of how they're telling the story, it's just a nice middle ground. It's just kind of an interest, you know, I can keep track of the story if I want and just kind of take note of the bits that I find interesting, but they're not really getting in the way of the gameplay, which is really what I, you know, play these games for. It does feel a lot like, you know, classic JRPGs, and I think it scratches a lot of that same itch for me. It does play around with themes a little bit, you know, like a lot of JRPGs do. They'll play around with themes of fate, or they'll talk about the planet having a soul and we gotta, like, protect nature. Or, you know, I mean, there's all these kinds of, like, tropes that we see in RPGs and JRPGs And that's certainly the same here. What seems to be kind of the main theme is authority versus free will, I think. Authority whose desire is to maintain peace and to, well, frankly, in this case, to eradicate evil. But to the point where their solution is to remove free will from humanity. And we've seen that a bunch of times, you know. I've seen that in movies where, you know, I've seen that in video games where it's such this extreme view of, like, it's not just that somebody wants to, like, present some kind of parameters of control for, you know, and boundaries for behavior so that we can, you know, have a safe and peaceful society. No, they want to eliminate human freedom and just start exterminating people that don't perfectly abide by the moral code that the authorities are setting up, you know. And then on the other extreme end is the heroes who are just all about free will and, you know, we got to have freedom. We got to have freedom of choice, you know, that makes us who we are and da-da-da-da-da. And there's a conversation to be had there in the relationship between free will and the nature of evil, and the problem of evil. There's a conversation to be had there, but when you present the two sides of that spectrum, if you want to call it that, in such extremes, it's like, well, what conversation is there to be had? Because, anybody, the person that's standing on the side of morality of any kind, or self-control of any kind, is so extreme, so extreme. And it seems like the other side is not even acknowledging the problems that that come from human freedom and from the exercising of our free will, you know. So anyway, it's the way that this game kind of treats that, it's almost like, I mean, I've seen it in so many games before. I wonder, you know, are the writers really trying to say anything, or do they just recognize, yeah, this is one of those, you know, like old tropes that are used in so many games and RPGs and stuff like that. Let's just do that, because that's what this game is. It's a hearkening back to, you know, it's not so much like a doing something new and bold, but a reviving of these things that have been done before. And so, you know, as I'm playing the game, I'm like, you know, the dialogue and everything is so shallow. I'd be a little bit surprised if, you know, someone on the writing staff was just like, man, I really want to get this message out there, you know? if that's the case, then, like, wow, they have a really, really overly simplistic, I think, view from, based on just the first 3 hours of gameplay, of the nature of human freedom and its relationship to the problem of evil and to morality and stuff like that. So, but anyway, all that aside, I'm picking nits a little bit there just because I like to find something to talk about, you know, in terms of like themes of moral or philosophical relevance. But I say all that as someone who, you know, likes to look for that stuff. I don't feel like this game is trying to be preachy or to say anything in particular. It's just, it is what it is. It's just kind of like this largely fun, empty in terms of its plot and theme content, RPG, you know, retro RPG experience, you know. And I found it a more interesting world with more interesting combat systems than I Am Setsuna, or at least combat systems that I could understand. I think that's one of the reasons I want to give I Am Setsuna another try, is because in the tutorial for that, and I mentioned this in my my trial and error video for I Am Setsuna, but like they show you these tutorial screens, it's like explaining the basic concepts of combat and equipment and how you upgrade and learn new abilities and stuff, how you activate abilities and stuff. And they give you those tutorial screens basically once, and then they don't ever give you access to those documents in game again. It's just like, I had one shot at memorizing all how these systems work, and anyway, so all right, I think I've babbled on enough about that. So I guess in summary, I'm enjoying it. It cost me, the pre-order price was like $14.95 or something like that. So I think the full price maybe is closer to $20. I'm not sure. But, you know, for $15 or $20, yeah, it's an enjoyable experience so far. It's one that I anticipate that I will be finishing. It's just not going to be one that, like, this is the game I'm playing right now. It'll probably be like one that I play 30 minutes of every now and then on a weeknight, you know, when I want to have a little bit of variety or when I'm in the mood for a different flavor. But I'm definitely more optimistic at this point about finishing it than finishing I Am Setsuna. So anyway, that's it for my thoughts on Cosmic Star Heroine. I want to remind you guys to go check out the other members of the Christian Geek Central Network, such as the Strangers and Aliens podcast, the Theology Gaming podcast, the Untold podcast, POSTOS, and Helix Reviews. All of these guys putting out great stuff. For more information about the CGC Network, visit ChristianGeekCentral.com.
Scanning for Christian Geeks. Subject located. Verifying status. Christian Geek status verified. Begin data transmission.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have to confess that I've been really busy. We're getting ready to move into a different house locally, which I'm very excited about for that new office space. But it did mean that I wasn't able to keep track as well of what might be going on in the world of Christian geekery that's new in the month of March. So what I'm going to do is share with you just some things that I've been wanting to share for a little while that aren't necessarily new, you know, in the world, but they're relatively new to me, and I'm happy to share them with you. The first is Geeks Under Grace. Now, this is a website that I've known about for a couple of years, but I knew in looking at it that it had some teaching content on there, and anytime I'm going to feature something, a website or a resource or something that has teaching content, I always like to get an idea of their statement of faith and where they're coming from. I just like to be, you know, thoughtful in what kinds of teaching I promote. And so anyway, they didn't have a statement of faith, and so I haven't promoted them up to this point, but more recently they at least put up a mission statement, which reads, "The mission of Geeks Under Grace is to educate Christians on how to safely consume pop culture from our worldview, evangelize geeks with the message of the gospel by building bridges between Jesus and the geek community, equip Christians and churches to reach geeks with the gospel, and encourage Christians as they grow into a deeper relationship with Christ." And as I've kind of checked back with them again and looked at their content and see kind of how their website has evolved and grown, I understand now why they haven't gotten into the weeds with a statement of faith. The teaching that you're going to run into is, first of all, not very frequent. They have a different focus, which I'll get to in a second. But when there is teaching, it mainly just focuses on the basics of the gospel and a few of the ramifications regarding our identity in Christ and our standing before God, but doesn't really wade into much more depth than that as far as its teaching goes. Their focus is really more about creating a bridge between geeks that are not necessarily believers. It is for Christian geeks, but it's also inviting those who are not Christians to see how there is an absolute compatibility between geek interests and Christianity. And so a lot of what you're going to find there, and they've got a ton of content on this site. Frankly, I'm envious. They've got a really slick-looking site as well. You're going to find tons of articles there on all kinds of different geek topics. A lot of it is going to be news that you would find elsewhere that a lot of times doesn't even necessarily have a Christian perspective included on it. So in that regard, I see this as a site to recommend to folks who maybe they want to, you know, still get their Christian geek news their geek news, their geek reviews and stuff like that, and they're not necessarily looking for a really intentional Christian perspective in all of their content, but they would like to learn about news and get reviews of games, at least in an environment that is Christian. Then I think that Geeks Under Grace is a fantastic resource. But I don't want to imply that their content is devoid, you know, of the gospel. You know, it's just kind of, you know, inconsistent in that regard. But just a fantastic, you know, when I started Spirit Blade Productions in 2006, one of the things that I saw a great need for was for people to see that there is absolute compatibility between Christianity and love of geek interests. And there just weren't sites that were really celebrating that and really, getting in, you know, acknowledging that at that time that I was aware of hardly at all, you know. And I think that the next step beyond that is to then invite Christians to go deeper into the Bible and examine, like, okay, now how do we approach life? How do we grow? How do we mature and stuff like that in light of what the Bible says about us and in light of who we are in terms of our temperament and stuff like that as geeks specifically, you know? So I think that's where I'd love to see more Christian sites going. But as far as that first category of just recognizing and putting a spotlight on the fact that there is absolute compatibility between the Christian life and the love of geek entertainment, I can't think of a site that's doing it with greater excellence than Geeks Under Grace, and that would include Christian Geek Central. So anyway, fantastic variety of and quantity of content at Geeks Under Grace. Dot com. They've also got a YouTube channel And even more so, I would say, on the YouTube channel, the focus is not necessarily presenting, a specifically Christian perspective on things. A lot of it's just kind of news that you would find elsewhere. But again, it's in a Christian environment. So I think if that's kind of what you're looking for, then you can definitely find that on the YouTube channel for Geeks Under Grace. Okay, and then the rest, I just want to kind of do a lightning round. I wanted to spend the bulk of my time on Geeks Under Grace and really shining a good spotlight on that. But I do want to do kind of a lightning round for a few YouTube channels that were recently introduced to me. The first is Mike and Adam's Dreams and Feelings. And this is just kind of like a weird, random humor kind of based conversational podcast. It says, a place for our old podcasts, video game projects, game news, movie news, and life as a missionary. So it's just kind of a weird hodgepodge of topics from two guys that are Christian geeks. The next one would be Full of Eyes. And this is a YouTube channel that's showcasing animated shorts. They're not necessarily geeky in theme. In fact, I'm not sure that any of them are geeky in theme. But if you're interested in just kind of encouraging a Christian indie animator in what he's doing, I think he's doing stuff with real excellence here in the realm of indie animation shorts. And neat stuff. And just interesting to check out as well. Genesis Animation Studio. This one is a little bit more focused in the realm of geek or kind of creative and abstract kind of stuff going on. And this is an animator who is working on an anime-inspired series that's currently in pre-production. So if you want to go and check out what he's doing and encourage him in that, you can find him on YouTube. Channel name is Genesis Animation Studio. Scott Bales Creative Costuming. If you've ever thought about getting into cosplaying, but you're like, I'm not sure, you know, how to go about doing costumes and stuff like that, then this is a Christian cosplayer that is putting out a number of videos to help you learn how to make some of these elements that are common to various types of cosplay costumes. Am I saying that right? I don't know anything about cosplay. Or, speaking of outside of my wheelhouse, I want to thank, am I saying this right? Takun? Takun? I'm not sure if the emphasis is Takun or Takun. I think it's Takun. And Zeru Baby Studio. I'm probably saying that wrong. This is like, if you are into, a Japanese, anime and manga and Japanese culture and just kind of a celebration of that, then this is a site I would definitely recommend checking out. She really produces her content with real excellence. She's a digital artist and an animator. Tons of different kinds of videos on her channel. And she's just got, you know, like a cute, fun vibe for her whole channel that really fits in. Like, if you're into like that cute, cutesy kind of vibe of certain flavors of anime, then I think you're going to find an ally and friend in Takun here. I had to look up in the definition of weeb. She describes herself as a Jesus weeb. And in the Urban Dictionary, it says a one-syllable contraction of weeaboo or weeaboo. I'm not sure how you pronounce that, which is internet for, I think that's pronounced Wapanese. And the sentence is that it's used in is, no, I don't collect animu figures. Maybe is that supposed to be anime? Maybe there's a thing called animu. This is so out of my wheelhouse. What kind of weeb do you think I am? And then weeb, second definition, a person who is obsessed with anime figures and manga. Dude, I showed my mom that anime last night and she finished the whole series in a day. I created a weeb. So anyway, she describes herself as a Jesus weeb, someone that wants to absorb herself and become like Jesus, even though at the same time she's celebrating her love of Japanese culture, entertainment culture. So, and it was Takun that introduced me to Full of Eyes, Genesis Animation Studio, and Scott Bales Creative Costuming. So thank you very much, Takun, for those recommendations. And, guys, check out her channel as well. If you want to check out the growing list of all kinds of geekery that's going on in the interwebs, then you can go over to ChristianGeekCentral.com, hover over Portal, and then go down to Gateway, and you'll see all kinds of places that you can go. Right here, this is just the page for podcast channels and blogs, and it is swiftly growing. Pretty soon, it's probably going to have to be subdivided into different categories as well. But anyway, all kinds of content that you can find out that Christian geeks are doing all over the place over at ChristianGeekCentral.com. I hope you'll join us there as we continue to geek out and seek the truth.
Data collection complete. Activating MusaNet 1.0.
This week at Christian Geek Central. No, where? YouTube.com/Christian Geek Central. You should, if I've done my job right, be able to find the Christian Geek Radar. Of the video version of the Christian Geek Radar segment that I've present on this show today. And then also part 5, I believe it is now, of my Gloomhaven board game playthrough. And this, if you watched the last episode of that, then I hinted or implied that this is not a video series to watch if you are hoping to learn how to play this game, because I get a lot of the rules wrong. But if you're just wanting to come along for the ride and enjoy me enjoying the fantasy, it's kind of like really, really structured play with action figures. No, it's not that. I mean, maybe it should be more like that. I'll bet that would be more entertaining. I'll think about that. Anyway, but no, this episode, things go totally off the rails in terms of my obedience to the rules. Up to this point, it's been accidental that I have not adhered to the rules, but it's gonna start getting purposeful now. So you can check that out. And also my Cosmic Star Heroine Try on Air video, which should be up by now. All of that at youtube.com. YouTube.com/Christian Geek Central. While you're there, if you want to like, share, or subscribe, that's just a great way to help to grow our community and hopefully get more people connected to what's happening at Christian Geek Central. All right, is all that done? I think it is.
Truth will set you free.
Truth is that which corresponds to fact or reality. To assert that truth is not absolute is a self-defeating proposition. Now, lots of things are possible, but our beliefs should reflect the best explanation of the available evidence. I'm no expert, but the information is out there. You'd be amazed what you can learn if you spend some time in search of truth.
The truth will set you free.
All right, guys. Well, in this segment, I attempt to examine the Bible and dissect some of the churchy language that we often take for granted, digging into history and languages when I'm able to try and get at the heart of the text so we can hopefully see and apply some of what God has for us in these words today. Now, I'm not formally trained in Scripture. I'm just a guy using resources and a questioning mind to try and get at the truth. And I hope that you'll do that with me. It's something that we can really all do with the kind of resources, both free and that can be purchased with just a little bit of investment. It's really just a wonderful time that we live in that we, I think, all could benefit greatly from taking advantage of. Now, normally we go through a book of the Bible, and we go just chapter by chapter, verse by verse, making our way through and finding as much as I can what is being said in the text intended by the original authors, the human author and the Holy Spirit together. And so we make our way through books that way. We've been going through the book of Ephesians. Today, I'm taking a short break to invite you guys into my process as I evaluate a proposed view of the Bible. As we'll see in upcoming verses of Ephesians, one reason that we are to seek unity with other Christians is so that we can stand firm in the truth rather than being carried about by every wind of doctrine, as we'll see is said in Ephesians 4, 14. I think that's right. Yeah, I think that's right. Okay. Anyway, I can't look it up now. If it's wrong, it's wrong. Sorry, guys. So anyway, the world of geek entertainment is like this big playground where numerous ideas are explored, many that challenge the Bible, and many others that will receive very different Christian responses depending on the individual Christian's view of the Bible itself. And now, in the last year, I've received an increased number of messages from people, either by email or YouTube comments or you know, just various ways, who see the individual passages of the Bible different from me. Maybe something I've put up, some video I put up where I said, this is how I think we ought to apply the Bible here, and they'll have a different view on, you know, that same verse or whatever, you know. And what I found is that they'll have a different view from me on a specific passage as I, you know, talk to them about it, not just because they see that passage differently than I do, but because they actually see the Bible as a whole in a significantly different way compared to the way I see it. So I think it's worth taking a look now and then at how we fundamentally view the Bible and how we evaluate the various foundational approaches to interpreting Scripture. At some point, maybe down the road, this will be a while because it's just a topic that I'm kind of studying right now, I might do, you know, just kind of a brief study or treatment of hermeneutics. You know, how do we view the text, and what are the rules that we should set in place for ourselves as we interpret the text in order to interpret it rightly? And where do we get those rules? Why do we choose those rules and adhere to those rules? You know, and I think that's just a wonderful thing to kind of have a grounding in, so that you're not always dependent on, you know, some teacher that's like, well, yeah, this guy seems to get it right, you know, pretty often. I'll trust him. I mean, we have to do that sometimes. But I think that there are some basic things about hermeneutics that each of us can learn if we just kind of decide not to be intimidated by the word hermeneutics, which doesn't have to be intimidating. And then we are equipped to engage with the Bible ourselves without, you know, always needing to, you know, ask someone else, you know, how should I view this? What does this mean? We have some tools in our tool belt that can help us on our own to figure out a good amount of things. Even though it's still very valuable to have people and resources in our lives that know more and that we can ask questions of. So anyway, one of the views that's become relevant to me in my conversations with others is, excuse me, I'm bumping my microphone all over the place, is the King James only view of the Bible. I've seen like some different kind of, I don't know if the word is gradients or, you know, kind of versions or shades of this view. Supporters of this view seem to either see the King James Version as superior to all other English translations, which is, you know, that's a bold claim, but you know, one that I'm open to looking at. And then a number of them will even go as far as saying that the King James Version of the Bible is actually the inerrant Word of God itself, which I think that there's a much heavier and more intense burden of proof for that. But it's still something that we can consider and evaluate the claims on that and what evidence there is for that. On the Jack Chick publication website, and yes, for those of you who have heard that name before, it is the Jack Chick, famous for those anti-D&D cartoons. But, you know, we don't want to just, you know, rule out anything he's going to say just because, you know, he kind of made a boneheaded move there and on maybe some other cartoons. But anyway, on his website, there's a portion of a book by Dr. Samuel C. Gipp that's reproduced, defending the idea that the King James English translation of the Bible is authorized by God. In other words, this view holds that the King James Version Bible is God's officially approved translation of the Bible into English. God puts his stamp of approval saying, yes, this is my official English version of my word to humanity. I don't hold the view that any translation of the Bible is itself the Word of God. I believe the Word of God is made up of the original text of the original manuscripts from which we get our Bible. To my mind, these written works that make up the Bible were each recognized as Scripture while in their original languages, and so the burden of proof lies with those who want to claim that translations of these works, not the works themselves, are equally the inspired Word of God. Those who challenge the inerrancy of the King James Version point to Acts 12:4 as one problem, and that's the one that we're going to look at today that was brought to my attention. In the King James Version, Acts 12:4 reads, "And when he had apprehended him, he put him in prison and delivered him to four quaternions of soldiers to keep him, intending after Easter to bring him forth to the people." And that's the key word, Easter. The Greek word translated Easter here by the King James Version means Passover every other time it is used, and does not refer to the pagan holiday of Easter anywhere else in the Bible, nor does the linguistic origin of the Greek word show any connection to the pagan holiday of Easter, in the lexicons that I've looked at anyway. Dr. Gipp defends the translation, and this was brought to my attention when a listener sent me a link to the Chick Publications page featuring Dr. Gipp's response. The issue surrounding this verse is a really interesting one. It's not one that I'd heard about before or read into at all before. I took some time out to chase this one down a bit, and I really wanted to take my time. And you know, when you guys send me questions, you know, biblical questions, philosophical questions, I really do like getting those. But I also really like to take my time on them. So I apologize if I'm a little slow to get back to you. And in this case, you know, sometimes it means cutting enough into my workday that I'm like, you know what? I think in this instance, I can actually leverage my time and use this as an in search of truth. So that's part of the reason actually why we're going this route, because there was enough of my time that I wanted to take up to really ponder this and think through it. It would have slowed down in search of truth a little bit. So, but I thought, hey, you know, two birds, one stone. This would be something worth bringing up, I think, on the podcast. So, anyway, I took some time to chase this one down a bit, and then I responded to the person who sent this to me, and then I took that response and kind of just made some little editorial changes and stuff so that I could share it with you guys here, and just kind of walk through with you my thinking. And you know, include red quotations from the website. So on this website, and I'll try to remember, please bug me if I forget, because I want you guys to have access to this, the original website. If you want, let's see, do I have that anywhere here? Hang on just a second. All right, I'm going to try and include this in, you know, in a link in the show notes or description or whatever. But just in case I forget and you don't want to wait to bug me about it, you can go to www.chick.com, get something to write with, /reading/books/158/158_02.asp. I'm not going to repeat that. You can go back and hear it again. Again, I will really try. Please bug me if I forget. Okay, so anyway, on this article, which is really something taken from Dr. Gipp's book, Dr. Gipp says, the Greek word which is translated Easter in Acts 12:4 is the word Pascha. I might be pronouncing that wrong. This word appears 29 times in the New Testament. 28 of those times, and he's talking about in the King James, 28 of those times the word is rendered Passover in reference to the night when the Lord passed over Egypt and killed all the firstborn of Egypt. See Exodus 12:12. Thus setting Israel free from 400 years of bondage. End quote. All right, so Dr. Gipp admits that in all other cases, the word is translated Passover, which means if the King James Version translators chose to translate it as the pagan holiday Easter instead, then this seems less a translation and more an editorial change or correction. Now, there is some speculation in my mind. It's like, I mean, I don't know history well enough to know if when this was translated somewhere around, 1611, if Christians were celebrating the resurrection of Jesus on the same day as the pagan holiday Easter. You know, we have that whole kind of evolution of how, you know, we call this Resurrection Sunday thing that we do. We call it Easter, even though the origin of the word Easter is in this, you know, pagan fertility deal and whatever. Anyway, so, you know, there's some speculation in my mind. I was like, well, were they just, is that what they meant? They were calling it already Easter by that time, and they just kind of lost sight. It seems like a weird thing to lose sight of in a translation. Anyway, so I really don't know. And I think that's where some of the criticism comes from. It's like, you know, this seems like an error, you know, for whatever reason, this seems like an error, you know. So anyway, back to my notes. This translation choice, Easter, for this word that otherwise is translated as Passover, seems less a translation to me and more an editorial change or correction. That's bold. At the end of the article, Dr. Gipp expresses his view of what is going on in the translation process here. He says, quote, thus we see that it was God's providence which had the spirit-filled translators of our Bible, King James, to correctly, all caps and in bold, translate Pascha as Easter. It most certainly did not refer to the Jewish Passover, unquote. So his position is that this editorial change was guided by the Holy Spirit. Perhaps he thinks it was actually correcting a mistake that had persisted in the manuscripts up until that time, or that in antiquity, Pascha did refer to the pagan holiday Easter at times, even though there seems to be, in my reading, no other historical slash linguistic evidence elsewhere of this being true. This strikes me as a really bold claim either way. If someone came along and said they had translated the Bible differently, in a way no other scholar had done before, and that it was the official English translation provided by Yahweh, I'd need to place the burden of proof squarely on their shoulders. I would need some evidence that the translators themselves were authorized, officially chosen by God. Do they have any miracles to authenticate their authority, as Jesus and the apostles did? If not, I don't see a reason to believe in their authority any more than that of, say, Joseph Smith, or the writers of the New World Translation, as it's called, created by the Jehovah's Witnesses. That doesn't mean, however, that I couldn't be convinced that the King James Version is a better translation of the original Greek in general compared to other translations. I just have to take the differences case by case, add them up, and comparatively see which translations seem to be doing better and develop my confidence in one or more translations that way. So in the matter at hand, that's what I really want to deal with. I'm not bringing this up to make some kind of big damning or, whatever kind of exclamation about the King James Version, just looking at this case by case. In the matter at hand, given Dr. Gipp's admission that Pascha refers to Passover and not Easter in every other instance of its use, the burden of proof, then, I think, lies on someone wishing to translate this word as something different from Passover. Dr. Gipp doesn't attempt proving this on a linguistic level so much as a logical one. He makes an effort to draw a distinction between Passover and the days of unleavened bread, as he says, which immediately followed the Passover meal each year. As evidence for this distinction, Dr. Gipp says, quote, "It must be noted that whenever the Passover is mentioned in the New Testament, the reference is always to the meal to be eaten on the night of April 14th, not the entire week," unquote. Dr. Gipp also says, quote, "This religious observance is stated more clearly in Numbers 28, verses 16 through 18, which reads in the King James, verse 16, "And in the 14th day of the first month is the Passover of the Lord," or Yahweh, as Lord is in all caps there. Verse 17, "And in the 15th day of this month is the feast. 7 days shall unleavened bread be eaten." Verse 18, "In the first day shall be an holy convocation. Ye shall do no manner of servile work therein." In verse 16, he says, we see that the Passover is only considered to be the 14th of the month. On the next morning, the 15th, begins the, quote, as he calls it, days of unleavened bread, unquote. And finally, Dr. Gipp also says, quote, "We see then from studying what the Bible," all caps and bold, the word Bible, has to say, "we see from studying what the Bible has to say concerning the subject that the order of events went as follows. Number one, on the 14th of April, the lamb was killed. This is the Passover. No event following the 14th is ever referred to as the Passover. Number two, on the morning of the 15th begins the days of unleavened bread, also known as the Feast of Unleavened Bread. It must also be noted that whenever the Passover is mentioned in the New Testament, the reference is always to the meal to be eaten on the night of April 14th, not the entire week. The days of unleavened bread are never, all caps and bold, referred to as the Passover. It must be remembered that the angel of the Lord passed over Egypt on one night, not 7 nights in a row." Unquote. All right, at the end of that second section of quotes, the author says that the 15th begins, as he calls it, the days of unleavened bread. But more precisely, the King James Version text, which he just quoted above it, refers to the 15th as the feast, which is odd. He even says in his second point, in that last section of quotes, "on the morning of the 15th begins the days of unleavened bread, also known as the Feast of Unleavened Bread." That's just interesting what he does there. Numbers 28, verse 17, the King James, it says, "And in the 15th day of this month is the feast, colon, 7 days shall unleavened bread be eaten." So notice here that the 14th day is the Passover, and the 15th day is the Feast of unleavened bread, not the days of unleavened bread, as he keeps using that phrase, assuming there is a difference. He also argues that the days of unleavened bread, as he calls it, are never referred to as the Passover. And he's really emphatic about that. But since the 7 days of eating unleavened bread are described as a single feast in Numbers 28:17, then I think Dr. Gipp has to figure out what he will do with Luke 22:1. In the King James itself, Luke 22:1 reads, "Now the feast of unleavened bread drew nigh, which is called the Passover." Luke says the feast here, which is the term used to describe what Gipp calls the days of unleavened bread in Numbers 28:17. So we see here that the feast of unleavened bread was, at the time Luke wrote these words, sometimes lumped in with the Passover. I think Dr. Gipp would at least have to concede that the Passover, as the word is used in Luke 22:1, includes the events of both the 14th and the 15th, even if he won't concede that it refers to, you know, the multiple days eating the unleavened bread after that. I think he at least needs to concede that it includes the 14th and the 15th, which presents some problems for the very strict distinction he's wanting to make between the Passover meal and the days of eating unleavened bread. I actually think there's very good argument in the text that Passover was sometimes used to also refer to what Dr. Gipp calls the days of unleavened bread. A couple different reference books and lexicons, including Thayer's Lexicon on BlueLetterBible.org and the Expositor's Bible Commentary from Zondervan Publishing, indicate that at the time Acts was written, Passover was sometimes used in a more popular sense to refer to both the 14th and its meal and the days of eating unleavened bread, despite this perhaps not being the original technical meaning of the word Passover in the Old Testament. In other words, it had its technical, precise meaning in the Old Testament, but there was this kind of popular usage of the word that had developed by the time Luke came to live and to write. So this seems to be how Luke is using the word in Luke 22:1, and since Luke also wrote the book of Acts, it seems more than possible that he would be using Passover in Acts 12:4 in this popular sense of including both Passover and the days of eating unleavened bread. So I hope you're not completely lost. I know that that's a lot of stuff talking about, you know, technical words and Passovers and Old Testament stuff, you know, and I know it's not always the most riveting stuff in the world, but I think this stuff is worth chasing down. Getting back to my notes, apart from some evidence that God supernaturally empowered the King James Version translators to make a perfect document, apart from some evidence of that, I'm much more convinced that the word in question here is being used in a different way, in which it was also known to be used elsewhere, rather than having a radically different meaning, that of Easter, that it was never known to mean elsewhere. So that's where I fall on the issue as far as like his argument of that word and trying to defend the translation of Easter there. I think there's a major burden of proof there, and I think his reasoning stacked up to what we find in Scripture of the use of these the words, you know, involved in the issue, his reasoning I think falls short. And as a side issue, Dr. Gipp's writing sends up some red flags for me, these are the kind of red flags that I'll see in other, you know, Christian publications that I'll go like, you're not helping your case here. It seems like you're injecting a lot of passion here to cover up the fact that your argument is not that strong. So red flags. One being he uses very emphatic and certain wording about things that, based on the biblical text, are not certain. He also bolds and capitalizes Bible in ways that imply, if you read that article, that the Bible is not being factored in by those who disagree with his position. You know, he'll say things like, you know, if we remember to read the Bible when searching for truth, you know, it's like, oh man, it's a little off-putting. It would be better, I think, for him to say that he finds the evidence for his reasoning very compelling or very convincing. But he uses such strong wording that when he is shown to be less than 100% correct, after using such strong wording, it really hurts his credibility in my eyes. When I find teachers doing things like this, I often just find myself kind of disregarding the rest of their work since they've been shown to make statements that are untrustworthy, and I'd rather not waste time verifying every one of their statements in the future. I also have doubts about his skills in logic and reasoning. Dr. Gipp says, how do we know that Herod was referring to Easter in Acts 12:4 and not the Jewish Passover? If he was referring to the Passover, the translation of Pascha as Easter is incorrect. If he was indeed referring to the pagan holiday Easter, then the King James Bible, published in 1611, must truly be the very word and words of God, for it is the only Bible in print today which has the correct reading. This argument doesn't at all follow logically. If the text was referring to Easter, which I don't think it was, as I've said, but let's say it was, this would at best show that the King James Version provided a more faithful translation of this verse. And it would also provide supportive evidence for the trustworthiness of the King James Version as a whole, assuming you can, you know, make a cumulative argument based on, you know, other instances where the King James Version does just a bang-up job of translating, you know? But it seems a massive leap in logic to assume that because only the King James Version is accurate in its treatment of this single verse, then the King James Version is therefore, as a whole, in its entirety, the infallible Word of God. I don't know how you get there. There seems to be a lot of steps in between that need to be covered. I think examination of these issues is much more productive when these kinds of extreme and reckless uses of language are just left out, and issues are studied just case by case instead of, you know, having this one issue that we hang, you know, an entire viewpoint on, you know. I'm not looking to start an ongoing debate on this issue here. I haven't spent any time evaluating the King James Version as a whole for its translation quality. My conclusion here is not intended as some, like, final damning word against the King James Version. So, you know, I'm open to arguments for it being superior to other translations. But in this specific case, I see what appears to be a real problem in the King James Version translation. And the burden of proof to establish the King James Version as God's official English translation, inerrant, is still a very heavy one. At the very least, you got to deal with this, and who knows what other kinds of issues. So, anyway, I hope that journey through my thought process was useful. Next time, we will be back in the book of Ephesians. Feedback. Give me your thoughts on this podcast, Christian Geek Central, the YouTube channel, or anything else we're doing. What should we keep? What should we change? Or what's on your mind you'd like a potentially uninformed opinion on? We want to make this show and all of Christian Geek Central as fun and useful as we can, but we've got to hear from you to do that. You can send me an email or audio file recorded on your phone, BAETER at spiritblade.com. Okay, I meant to put this in my notes for In Search of Truth last week, and it didn't make it. I'll probably bring it up again. But, you know, we've been talking about unity and peace amidst disagreement, amidst differences. And I wanted to put out as an example there for you guys, Dr. William Lane Craig. This is he's an apologist who's been defending the Christian faith for many years. But the reason I want to point you to him is not, in this instance, because of his apologetics work. If that doesn't interest you and you're like, I'm not really into that, that's fine. I'm recommending him right now for a very different reason. This is a man who has been in many conversations by people who are harsh and rude and dismissive toward him and toward what he believes. And he handles those conversations with such grace. I am amazed at this guy, you know. I've been listening since I started my new exercising routine in January. I've been binge listening every time I jog to his Defenders podcast series, which I would highly recommend. And that's more of like a systematic theology series that he updates the curriculum for every time he finishes going through it. He's currently on his third pass through, more than halfway done, but you can listen to all of Defenders Series 1 and all of Defenders Series 2 over at reasonablefaith.org. And as you, and you can also find his debates online. And I recommend watching his entire debates, not just clips that Christians put up, you know, of how great he is, or clips of that atheists put up of what a dork he is or how wrong he is or whatever. But hearing his entire debates in context is really, really just shows the strength of his arguments and the grace with which he faces opponents that are just kind of rude, you know, and dismissive of him. So anyway, I think he's just a wonderful model to us of grace, and you know, and the reality that being gracious does not mean compromising truth or, you know, holding back on expressing your view. That, you know, sometimes we can fall into the mistake of thinking that, like, grace and truth means that, you know, you want to have not too much of either, you know. No. No, we want an equal amount of both, but we don't. But they are not mutually exclusive. Being more gracious should not mean a reduction of truth, and being more truthful should not involve a reduction of grace in the delivery of that truth. And I think William Lane Craig is a guy, you know, to see him as a model of, you know, handling his relationships, his interactions with others with such grace. And you even see that, you know, in the way he talks about opposing viewpoints and non-believers and stuff in his Defenders class. His Defenders series is primarily for an audience of Christians. It's taught, I believe, on a church campus. You know, it's kind of a Sunday school type class, I believe. But I mean, non-believers are certainly welcome. And as the series goes on, you'll hear more and more people. You know, he always has a Q&A section in each segment, in each lesson, you know. And so people that are there and listening are free to come to the mic and ask questions and stuff. And they get a little bit better starting in, I would recommend starting with Defenders 2. That series is complete, and technically they get better at miking those people so you can hear their questions better. I'm listening to Defenders Series 3 right now, and there are people that, you know, I wonder, is like, oh, is this person, you know, not a Christian? Is, like, they're really disagreeing with with him strongly, and, you know, and so just hearing the grace with which he handles those questions, and the grace with which he, the generosity with which he talks about people who are non-believers or who disagree with him, you know. And just his willingness also to say, on some issues, when he is unsure, he'll say, I don't know, I'm not sure. You know, I find this more persuasive than this, but da-da-da-da-da. So if you just want a great example of, you know, what I think Ephesians is calling us to, what I'm trying to bring out of Ephesians as I see it there, you know, this idea of let's be a community of both grace and truth at the same time, and how those are not, you know, battling each other, but they're meant to be in unity. I think Dr. William Lane Craig is a great example of how they are absolutely compatible, and to see him do what he does is sometimes just a wonder. I'd love to sit down with him and ask him not some deep apologetic question, although I do have one. There's like an issue that I'm like, I want to know exactly how you're using this word, because depending on how you're using it, I have major issues. But no, I'd like to sit down with him now at this point, the more I listen to him, and say, what is it in your heart? What brought your heart to this place? How did God shape your heart? Through what circumstances or thoughts, or how did you your heart arrive at this place? Because this is clearly more than something you're just pasting on. This is something that is genuine, and I want to understand it. I want to have a heart more like yours, because I think that from what I'm seeing of your heart, it's more like the heart of Jesus than mine is. So I'd love to learn from guys like William Lane Craig. Anyway, more of him and the Defenders podcast at reasonablefaith.org. All right, that's it, guys. Stay tuned for DS9 Shawarma after the credits, or jump back to episode 400 if you want to start from the beginning. Next week, if God allows it, we'll come back to my bookshelf tour, which I've stepped away from for a while. And even though I'm packing up and moving my house and leaving the bookshelf behind, I took a video of all the contents of my bookshelf so that I could finish out this series going forward. I may buy a new bookshelf, I'm not sure, we'll see. But anyway, next up in that bookshelf tour, I'll be talking about some PlayStation 2 RPGs that I really have enjoyed. And then also I'm going to talk about my experience so far with the Assassin's Creed video game series. And then also we're going to jump back into the long box with Winston Crutchfield, who's going to tell us about Doctor Who. Till then, check out SpiritBlade.com and Christian Geek Central for more stuff made just for you guys. Thank you so much for making time for this show. I hope you have a great week, and that you'll join me next time here on the Spirit Blade Underground podcast as we continue to geek out and seek the truth.
The Spirit Blade Underground is a community-supported endeavor of Spirit Blade Productions. This podcast is produced by Painter Fremson with support from the Christian Geek Central community at ChristianGeekCentral.com. For information about the latest entertainment and resources from Spirit Blade Productions, visit SpiritBlade.com. Thank you for listening.
Something's coming through the wormhole.
The Dominion has endured for 2,000 years and will continue to endure long after the Federation has crumbled into dust.
No!
5 years ago, no one had ever heard of Bajor or Deep Space Nine, and now all our hopes rest here.
And that was Defiant. A really good episode, I thought.
Yeah, it was a pretty good one.
It's the return of Riker to Deep Space Nine, but not the Riker we saw. If you remember from one of Pater's Farscape shorts, he referenced this episode, but he didn't know the full story of what happened. There was a TNG episode near the end of the series where Riker, we find out years before, had been split into two people. A transporter cloning, if you will. And neither one was really the copy, but this guy was identical to the Riker we had all known on the Enterprise. And then he came and got, and he started a career of his own, because for a change, they hadn't hit the reset button. And at the end, Riker's double was still out there, called himself Tom Riker. That's his middle name. And we've never heard of him since then, and we kind of forgot. And Riker comes on board Deep Space Nine, excuse me, and then hijacks the Defiant, and which is, you know, name of the episode and all. And then we find out it's actually Tom Riker, that he joined the Maquis. And this isn't too much of a spoiler, because this isn't the first act. Because most of the episode is about Sisko and Gul Dukat have to team up to try to get the Defiant back or to destroy it before it starts a war. Because you remember, the Maquis are sort of like a renegade group of Federation citizens who are waging their own small-scale war with the Cardassians and the Federation, because there's enemies, because they might draw the Federation into a war. It would be like if after the Civil War, if a group of Southerners just went off on their own and kept attacking U.S. installations. It would be like the Southern states would not like that, because you might drag us right back into a war. Yeah, same idea. And so the episode is all about the tactics and what they have to do to try to stop Tom Riker for what he's about. Probably the best part of this episode, I would say, is that this does point to something that's going to happen later on this season. Where we find out there's some mystery going on in this one sector, which is the reason they're going to, why they took the Defiant. And we're going to find out what this mystery is later on down the road. It's still a mystery now, but it's just a nice hint, and it reminds us that when we get to that point, they knew what was coming. They had foreshadowed this. This was not something they pulled out of their hat. And I love that Deep Space Nine does that. We see sometimes, you know, these hints of just backward continuity and forward continuity. That they've got a plan, and they're putting things into motion, and hints about the future, and mm-hmm. they're like with the Dominion stuff.
They don't pull anything out of their butt on DS9.
Yeah.
They've got plans, you know, a whole season ahead, basically.
Yeah.
The other thing I liked in this episode was the Sisko Dukat interaction.
Yep, they make a good team, either as adversaries or allies.
But yeah, put those two in a room and just let them act at each other, and that's a good show.
And later on in season 6, when we get the episode called Waltz, the entire episode is Dukat and
Sisko. It's a two-man play.
Yeah, and it's an amazing episode. It's one of the top ones.
But in this one we get to see, and this is something that I also appreciate about DS9, is that they have villains who are not just cackling tools.
Yes.
They have...
He is a very nuanced, shaded character.
Oh, yeah. Dukat has a lot of depth to him, and we get to see some of that in this episode.
And you also see some of just his competence and his abilities.
Mm-hmm.
Despite the fact that he's being told he's incompetent, but he's actually quite competent. The only thing I would say is disappointing about this episode is, and I don't want to ruin it because, you know, I don't want to ruin the episode completely, but at the end, something happens, and they even promise to follow up on it. And they never do. And it's very disappointing. because there's a great story potential. And, you know, of all shows to not follow up a major plot point like this, you'd expect out of Deep Space Nine the least.
Yeah.
And as the show said on station, it doesn't go anywhere, they have no excuse of saying, like, they got left behind or something. And, you know, they could have worked it in with the Dominion story, with prisoners the Dominion was holding in the future, and all sort. There's any number of ways they could have worked this in. And it's, I have a feeling that they just kind of forgot, or maybe they couldn't get the actor involved. If he was busy doing other things.
Yeah, it might have been something where they couldn't get Jonathan Frakes back.
But even then, they could have like at least followed up with a line of dialogue, say that this person died or something. So it's disappointing they didn't follow that up. Because there's a lot of potential. And again, they actually go out of the way to say, we'll see you again. We're not dropping this. And it's really sad. It's one of those rare things that DS9 dropped the ball.
Yeah, it's one of those where you notice it because they usually don't do that. They usually do so well, and on this one instance, they disappointed you.
They usually follow up even when it seems like it's wrapped up, they'll follow it up.
Yeah.
But other than that, this, I would say, is not quite necessarily essential viewing because you don't need to know about the foreshadowing, just like with all the Dominion stories, but it's a good episode. It reminds us about things and it shows us more details, and it does foreshadow one of the first major events of Deep Space Nine since we met the Dominion.
And it's got a pretty good space fight in it.
Yeah, the first major space fight we're going to see, the first big one, is going to be in that episode I mentioned. That's coming up later this season. This has some good space action. It's a good foreshadow. You start to see that despite the fact that the first time we saw the Defiant, it got its butt kicked. It was going right into to Dominion territory non-aggressively. But, when we see that the Defiant isn't just being overwhelmed by Jem'Hadar, it can hold its own. It is a, quote-unquote, tough little ship. So, that's about it for this episode. Definitely check it out if you get the chance. And we'll see you next time. Oh, we're going on a big drop. Oh. We're going into Fascination.
Oh. Gird yourselves, folks.
We're
gonna suck.
We're regaining with Lwaxana Troi. Oh.